Hello and welcome to our second podcast summary of activities supporting consistent application. So our first podcast covered activities in the quarter to June 2019. So this podcast will cover activities between June and September 2019. It includes the most recent Interpretations Committee meeting in September and also an update on a couple of the board's narrow scope projects. I'm Patrina Buchanan, a member of the ISB's technical staff, and I'm joined today by Sue Lloyd, Vice Chair of the Board and Chair of the Interpretations Committee. So let's start with the committee meeting in September, which took place on the 17th here in London. So the committee discussed nine topics, six of which resulted in finalised agenda decisions, and they also discussed three new topics. So I'm going to start with the finalised agenda decisions. The committee considered comment letters received on six tentative agenda decisions and decided to finalise those agenda decisions. Now, we're only going to talk about a couple of these given the time we have, but I'm going to list all the topics so that you can identify what might be relevant for you. So the topics finalised were disclosure of changes in financing liabilities, fair value hedge accounting, which we'll discuss, compensation for delayed or cancelled flights, very relevant to the airline industry, which we discussed in the June podcast. A lessee's incremental borrowing rate, that's of course related to IFRS 16 and also discussed in the June podcast. Presentation in the balance sheet of uncertain tax amounts that are recognised applying IFRIC 23. And finally, subsequent expenditure on biological assets measured at fair value. So a question on IAS 41. Now, Sue, I'm going to ask you to comment on a couple of these. And maybe you could start with disclosure of changes in financing liabilities.
Okay, sure. So interestingly, this question was one that came from investors, I think, for the first time for the Interpretations Committee. And it relates to new disclosure requirements that have been added to IAS 7, specifically paragraphs 44A to 44E. These were added in 2016 and they were designed to provide information to investors about the cash flows and the financing of a company. So the agenda decision sets out some helpful reminders about the requirements, say, and how a company should go about meeting the disclosure objective. Importantly, what the agenda decision does is highlights that a company must be satisfied that its disclosures do indeed meet the disclosure objective that's set out in paragraph 44A, which is to enable investors to evaluate changes in liabilities arising from financial activities, including both changes that arise from cash flows and non-cash changes. And really the main point of the agenda decision is to say that it's not enough to say I provided a reconciliation. A reconciliation needs to meet the disclosure objective.
Great, thank you. And maybe there's just one more I'd actually ask you to say a few words on, which is the agenda decision on fair value hedge accounting.
Sure. So the question that the committee discussed was about whether a company can apply fair value hedge accounting by designating a foreign currency risk component of a non-financial item when that non-financial item is held for consumption, and whether that can be treated as a hedged item in accordance with IFRS 9. So let's make this a bit more real. Imagine an airline. It owns an aircraft. It's on its balance sheet, and it expects to use that aircraft in its operations. The question is, can the airline designate a foreign currency risk component of the owned aircraft as the hedged item in a fair value hedge applying IFRS 9? So in addition to focusing on the specific question that came in, I think the agenda decision hopefully is also helpful just to remind people how to walk through the relevant requirements in IFRS 9. It sets out how a company should think about their requirements and apply them. And in response to the comments we received, the final agenda decision emphasises that in order to apply hedge accounting, IFRS 9 requires that there's an alignment between the hedge and the company's risk management objectives and strategy for managing the exposure. So the agenda decision notes that it's possible for somebody to hedge foreign currency risk component in this situation, but although it's possible, the committee would expect an entity to manage and hedge exposure to foreign currency risk on the fair value of, say, PP&E held for consumption, only in very limited circumstances. And if, for example, a company's risk management activities aims only to reduce the foreign currency volatility on a foreign currency borrowing, then that risk management activity would not be consistent with designating a component of a non-financial asset as a hedged item. And that's because, you know, put simply, the company's managing an exposure on foreign currency borrowing, not managing the exposure on foreign currency risk on the non-financial asset, which is what they wanted to designate as the hedged item. So I think that's an important agenda decision for people looking at hedging questions.
Great, thank you, Sue. So that's the finalised agenda decisions. I'm now going to move on to the three new topics that the committee discussed. And here what might be slightly confusing for people is that the three new topics has actually resulted in publishing five tentative agenda decisions. And the reason is that one of the topics, which relates to hyperinflationary foreign operations, actually had three separate questions embedded within one submission. Now, before I ask Sue to comment on those topics, I'll just remind you that these tentative agenda decisions are now out for comment for 60 days until the 25th of November. So we encourage you to comment on any and all of these that are of interest to you. So for each of those cases, the committee decided to publish tentative agenda decisions because it concluded that standard setting is not needed, having applied its decision-making criteria in the due process handbook. So now in asking for comments on these, we're really asking you two things. The first is whether you agree with the committee's conclusion that standard setting isn't needed. And secondly, whether you agree with the technical analysis in the tentative agenda decisions. So the new topics related to IFRS 15, IFRS 16, and in fact, a couple of old standards, ISs 21 and 29. So I'm going to ask you if you could walk through the questions and what the committee has tentatively concluded.
Okay, so the first one was about training costs that a company incurs to fulfil a contract. And I think really this is a question about the interaction between IFRS 15, the new revenue standard, and IAS 38. So the question that the committee was asked was whether a company recognises an asset or an expense when it incurs training costs to fulfil a contract with a customer. So as an example, imagine a company that signs a contract with a customer to provide online telephone support for a customer's equipment. So to provide that service to the customer, the company needs to train its employees to understand the customer's equipment, and the company can recharge those training costs to the customer. So the easy part of your journal entry is credit cash. The more difficult question is, what do you debit? Do you debit an asset or do you debit an expense when you incur those training costs? And the committee concluded in the tentative agenda decision that the debit is an expense. So the company recognises the costs as an expense when it incurs them. And that's because such training costs are within the scope of IAS 38. And paragraph 69 of IAS 38 requires expenditure on training activities to be recognised as an expense when it's incurred. Now, importantly, the committee discussed whether the company's right to recharge those costs to the customers would or should have any influence on the outcome of whether that debit entry I was talking about is asset or expense. And the committee concluded that it doesn't have an effect on the conclusion. That's really a separate question, which is, if I've got the right to recharge the customer, do I have a receivable and then a credit entry maybe for contract liability under IFRS 15? But it doesn't affect the first journal entry, which is credit cash and debit asset or expense for the actual training costs incurred. The committee also noted that in this fact pattern, the recharge would be considered to be an embedded part of the consideration paid for the service, and it would not be accounted for separately from other consideration in the contract. So the next question I'll talk about is on another one of the new standards, IFRS 16, and it's about the definition of a lease. So the first thing you need to think about when you pick up the standard. And the specific question that the committee received was a question about a particular shipping contract, and one in which a lot, almost all, of the relevant decisions about the use of a ship are predetermined in the life of the contract. So the contract specified the quantity and the type of goods that would be transported on the ship, the destination, the overall number of voyages over the five-year term of the contract, but the customer did retain the right to decide upon the starting port for each voyage, and importantly, that gave the customer the ability to influence the economic benefits to be derived from the use of the ship. So the submission asked whether the customer has the right to direct the use of the ship in that situation if it retains some decision-making rights, but only a small part of the decision-making rights, with all of these other decisions being predetermined. And again, I think this is a good agenda decision just to aid understanding of how to apply, you know, quite a new concept in one of the new standards. So the committee concludes in the tentative agenda decision that yes, in this situation that we looked at, the customer has the right to direct the use of the ship. So in the contract submitted, the customer's right to decide upon the starting point for each voyage is a relevant decision about how and for what purpose the ship is used, as that's described in IFRS 16, remembering importantly that it's assumed that the right gave the customer the ability to influence the economic benefits. And even though most of the how and for what purpose decisions were predetermined, the fact that the customer's right to make all the relevant decisions that could be made during the five-year term of the contract is sufficient to give it the right to direct the use of the ship as that term is used in IFRS 16. So that's two questions on two pretty new standards. As Petrina said, the next set of questions we got related to some of the older standards, IAS 29 on accounting for hyperinflation and IAS 21 accounting for foreign currency. And it was one topic that gave rise to three sub-questions that the committee looked at. And to give you the context for the question that we've got, these questions are coming up at the moment as a consequence of Argentina becoming a hyperinflationary economy from mid-2018. So lots of questions are coming up where you have got a country or a company that's going into hyperinflation accounting. And in particular, the questions that we were looking at arise when you've got a parent company that's preparing consolidated financial statements in a non-hyperinflationary currency, say euros or US dollars or sterling, and that parent company needs to translate the results and the financial position of its Argentinian subsidiary that from mid-2018 has got a hyperinflationary functional currency. So the first question that the committee looked at was asking about the presentation of differences that result from firstly restating the financial statements of the Argentinian subsidiary applying IAS 29 to reflect the effects of hyperinflation, and then translating those restated financial statements into the group's non-hyperinflationary presentation currency applying IAS 21. So for this question, the committee concluded that applying IAS 21, exchange differences are presented in other comprehensive income. They're not recognised directly in equity. However, a company needs to determine whether the entire difference that results from applying IAS 29 and IAS 21 meets the definition of an exchange difference, or only a part of that difference is an exchange difference. So do you recognise all or only some of the effect in OCI? Now, on this question, I could go into lots more detail, but I think you'd all fall asleep. So if you are interested in this topic, I really recommend that you have a look at the staff paper that supports this agenda decision and the tentative agenda decision itself for more details, because I think there's some really helpful worked examples in there. Now, the second question that came up related to this fact pattern asked about exchange differences when the Argentinian subsidiary first becomes hyperinflationary. So until 2018, a parent would have presented exchange differences relating to its Argentinian subsidiary in OCI. And the question asked is whether the parent can reclassify or should reclassify those pre-hyperinflation exchange differences to a different component of equity. And why does this matter? Well, if the hyperinflation exchange differences are reclassified to another component of equity, then they would not be reclassified to profit or loss on disposal of that subsidiary in the future. Whereas if they are retained in OCI, they would be reclassified to profit or loss on disposal of the subsidiary. So it's actually a pretty big deal. The committee concluded in the tentative agenda decision that the parent should retain the pre-hyperinflation exchange differences in the separate component of equity that then is reclassified to profit or loss on disposal of the subsidiary. So it stays within OCI. Now, the final question of the three sub-questions are related to the presentation of comparative amounts when the Argentinian subsidiary first becomes hyperinflationary. Based on the outreach and the analysis that we did, we identified very little diversity in reporting. Companies generally do not restate comparative amounts in this situation. So the committee has not identified any widespread issue in this respect, and as a result, actually did not analyse this question.
Great. Thank you very much, Sue, for covering that. So that was the committee meeting in September. So now I think it's worth moving on and just talking about the progress that the board has made over the last couple of months on a couple of narrow scope projects that in fact both started life as a submission to the Interpretations Committee. In both projects, the board is proposing amendments that actually aim to improve financial reporting in two ways. First, by proposing accounting that would faithfully represent the transactions in question. And secondly, would actually improve consistency of application by actually specifying how to account for particular transactions when more than one approach is actually possible today. So the first project actually relates to deferred tax, all of our favourite subject. And in July, the board published an exposure draft of proposed amendments to IAS 12. Now, this proposed narrow scope amendment deals with deferred tax on transactions such as leases and decommissioning obligations, where costs are deductible for tax purposes when paid. So, for example, this is the case when the deduction is for the amount of the lease payments, and you get that deduction when the payments are made, which is the case in many jurisdictions. Now, the comment period in that exposure draft is open until the 14th of November. And really, for anyone who is as scared of deferred tax as I am, then I'd really recommend reading the in-brief article, which was written by board member Gary Cabrick, which is actually available on our website on the project page. So how to find that? You go onto our website, click into the board's work plan, then click into the IAS 12 amendments project page, and then finally click on the tab Supporting Material to find that article. Now, the article is only 9 pages long, and it really explains both the basics of deferred tax and the proposals in a really reader-friendly way using lots of examples. So in summary here, the board's proposals would result in companies recognising deferred tax on leases and decommissioning obligations to the extent temporary differences arise. Now, the second project I'm going to mention relates to the onerous contract test in IAS 37. So the board proposed that when you're assessing whether a contract is onerous, a company includes all costs that relate directly to a contract as part of the costs of fulfilling that contract. So costs would include both incremental costs as well as an allocation of costs that relate to contract activities. Now, today, some companies include only incremental costs in that assessment, whilst others include all costs. And this has resulted in differences in reporting practices. And so the board has considered comments received in that project and just in September decided to proceed with the proposed amendment. Now, Sue, I think the board really had a very good discussion on this in September. And in particular, I'm thinking about the board's consideration of contract price to exceed incremental costs, but not priced to cover all costs. And so although really a lot of the respondents to this ED supported the board's proposals, there were some concerns in this respect. So maybe you could comment on that.
Sure. So there were some respondents who had concerns that contracts that might be priced to exceed the incremental costs of fulfilling the contract and to sort of partly cover some other costs but not recover in full, the full cost of fulfilling the contract, would be required to book an onerous contract, whereas if they hadn't entered into any contract at all, so hadn't been able to recover any of those sort of broader costs, they wouldn't have had to recognise an onerous contract. And they say, well, we're better off by entering into that contract because at least we're recovering some of those costs. So, you know, why do I have to look worse by recognising an onerous cost? And you can see why, at first instance, that might seem a difficult thing for people to accept. And I think we had a good discussion about this. Firstly, noting that if this was a sort of seasonal thing within reporting periods, then the effect would tend to sort of work itself through the system within the reporting period. And of course, ultimately, your overall results will be improved because you have brought in more revenue than you otherwise would have. But also the other point that was noted was that it does provide useful information to investors because by committing to perform the contract, you're sort of having to hang on to idle capacity rather than, for example, having the choice of being able to sell it. And so that is there is a consequence of entering into these contracts, and we thought that that does provide useful information. It doesn't mean it's a bad decision, and I can see that people might want to provide extra disclosure to explain, the rationale for the contracts, but the board decided that it was the appropriate outcome and to proceed on that basis. And I guess the only other thing I'll add before maybe we'll wrap up will be that the board agreed to proceed to finalise this despite the fact that we are talking about a potentially broader project on IES 37, because the reason that this question initially came to the Interpretations Committee is that with the introduction of IFRS 15, people now need to use IES 37 more frequently in order to assess whether contracts are onerous or not, and that's why it's quite important that we get this finished on a timely basis.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Sue, for that. So with that, that brings our update for this quarter to a close. We thank you for listening to our podcast today and really hope that you found it useful. Please email communications@ifrs.org if you have any suggestions for improvement. So thank you and goodbye.